of now, and the audio recording along with tonight's deck and the contents of the chat window will be posted on our website later on this evening. So I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. As usual, we have a host of different things, so stay tuned. First up, is anybody here tonight because they've seen our event posted somewhere? I'm thinking of the Council on Aging of Ottawa, Meetup, Ottawa Seniors, or perhaps Twitter or Facebook. And if you're from any of those venues, we'd love to hear from you, so just drop us a note in the chat window. There was a pre-meeting question about renewing memberships, and I just remind everybody who is a current member that the board has decided to extend memberships by another year, so nobody who is a member right this minute has to renew their membership. However, if you have friends or relatives who are desperate to join the Ottawa PC Users Group, we have a special offer. Because we're giving an extra year's membership, anybody who joins the club before March the 31st, i.e. pays the $20 membership fee, you will actually get 2 years for the price of one. So, as I think I said last week, it's a much better deal than this beer advert here. So if you know of anybody who wants to join the club, now is a really good time to spend your lousy $20. Okay, moving along. Our first share tonight, Chris has some words of wisdom on a Windows update.
Not a lot to say. This has got to be the most measly feature update to Windows 10 that I've ever seen. So for anybody who doesn't know, twice a year, Microsoft comes out with feature updates, usually in spring and fall. And the next feature update has been released to the insider beta channel. So this is sort of their release candidate sort of idea. And so there should be no more new features added to it. There will be bug fixes and that going on until the general release, which Microsoft is just claiming first half of 2021. I think we can probably expect it in April or May at the latest. It is, as I said, very skimpy on new features. There's a Windows Hello camera enhancement, specifically dealing with when you have multiple cameras that are available. And beyond that, I didn't understand what was really going on. Windows Defender Application Guard has performance improvements with specific scenarios. It's not an overall general thing. They tuned some stuff. And then WMI Group Policy Service also has performance improvements. And that's all that they're admitting to at this point in time, really. It will be one of their new optimized delivery ones. So if anybody is currently on 2004 or 20H2, then it should go in very, very quickly. Typically what happens is most of it installs in the background. Then you get the notice to reboot. When you reboot, it'll be more like a regular monthly update where probably a couple of minutes and you'll be back up and running. For anybody who wants to read up on it, anything more, the URL is there, and I will actually paste that into the chat window. That's all I have on that one.
Okay, thanks. Kareem was just asking if new members can be from anywhere, and you certainly don't have to be an Ottawa resident to join the club, and it looks as though, at least for the near future, we're going to be continuing with video conference meetings since we can't do face-to-face right now. And we've just had a couple of recent members join from BC. So obviously you can, anywhere across Canada, you can join our meetings these days. Okay, moving along. Chris has another share, Michael Geist.
Yeah, I just came across this today, actually. Michael Geist is a law professor at University of Ottawa, and he's the Canada Research Chair on Internet e-commerce and law or something like that. Anyhow, he puts out this podcast, and his episode 77 is on the complexity of Internet content regulation and conversation with this gentleman. I don't know what CIPPIC actually stands for, but I listened to it. It's about a half an hour, and I thought it was really interesting. There's a lot of nuances to when you start talking about content regulation, which is really in the news now with, you know, Facebook and Google in particular being hammered for content regulation and having to pay, or being threatened with having to pay media companies for click-throughs and things like that. So if you're interested in spending half an hour and finding out a little bit more information from the point of view of some people in the law who really know what's going on, the URL is there, and I will paste that into the chat as well.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So just a reminder to people, if you have apps that you like for your Android phone or even for your PC, we're always interested to hear about them. And as it happens, I've been working recently on some program files, and I've been using Notepad++, which is, in my view, a much better notepad than Microsoft's Notepad. So Notepad++, this is the main screen. You can see there's a ton of icons there. It basically runs on the Windows. It's essentially a replacement for Windows Notepad. However, this one is completely free, and it's also open source. The main features are that it supports multiple tabs for editing a number of files and having them all available at once, essentially. It acts as a programmer's editor because it has program language syntax built in, and will highlight the source code. So if you're a programmer, it's quite a useful way to update your source code. And another feature I've used very successfully are the search commands. It has really powerful search commands. And the final thing I like is that it has a whole raft of plugins, and one in particular I found very useful. I'll touch on in a few seconds. So this is an example of tabbed editing. I'm basically following some source code. Some of you may recognize this as DBase from, 20, 30 years ago. But it's basically a set of subroutines. And I open the first file, and it tells me that it's calling the second file, which calls the third file, which calls this file. And even this file is calling another file. So as I'm following this series of subroutines, I can jump back and forward, and I can see, you know, what this one calls. But I can also look and see how were my variables set in the previous files. So it's a very convenient way to handle multiple text files if you need to refer to the different files as you go along. Another example, similar kind of thing, where I have this file called index, which is an index to the question and answer topics. And I'll typically use this once I've got a complete list of topics for a given day. I'll use that to populate one of the web pages. But for now, I really just want to grab the current topics and copy them from this file and drop them into tonight's reminder file, so that not only do I tell you what day and time and give you the Zoom link, I can also tell you more or less what you're going to see. And again, it's very convenient to have both files, and I can just copy from one and paste into the other one. So that's tabbed editing, really useful. Here's an example of syntax highlighting. You might recognize this as HTML code, and you can see how all the different attributes on the various tags are color-coded with blue and red and black and all kinds of things. So it's very easy to move around the different sections of the document and the different kind of tags. Here's the plugins screen. If you hit the plugins menu here and go to plugins admin, then you find you've got this list of available plugins. And you can see here, you can scroll down quite a way. So there's a lot of different plugins. It also has a search box. So I can type in compare and then go and find that. And here's the compare utility. So I just tell it to install the compare plugin. So now when I hit plugins, I've got my compare utility available. And what I've done is I've opened two different files here. Here's my index file, and here's the old version of it. And I'm going to basically just hit compare here and compare the two files. So there's the old file, and here's the new file. And you can see the new lines that I've added are highlighted, and it's pretty obvious to see what is different between the two files. So that's a really nice feature for text editing. Here's the search. If I hit the search menu item here, I get a whole raft of stuff. I can search things, I can replace things, I can do incremental searches. The really good one is finding files. If I hit finding files, then I can look for Chris Taylor, and I can filter the files I'm going to look in, and I'm going to look in starchat.txt, because that's the chat window is saved to a text file, and I usually put a date in front of it, and then all the different chat files are called something chat.txt. So I'm going to look for Chris Taylor's posts in all of the chat files, which are in my working subdirectory for the various presentations, the Q&A presentations. And if I have a main folder, note that I can also check, look in all the subfolders. So it will check every file in every subfolder of wherever I tell it to go look. And when I do that, lo and behold, it finds two different files, February 10th and February 17th. And because I asked it for Chris's posts, you can see that he posted on line 1 and 3 and et cetera, et cetera. So if you're looking for something in a whole range of files, it's a really powerful technique to be able to find text amongst a whole raft of information. Very, very useful. So that's Notepad++, highly recommended by yours truly. Okay, our next share is a fairy tale from Bob Walker, who I believe is going to share his screen and take us through his slides.
Okay, well, let's try it here. Okay. And
there we go.
Okay, so tonight I'm going to be talking about ebook file formats. A few weeks ago, I started out on this talking about BookBub and a couple other places to get deals on ebooks, and then did another bit of a talk on where to get free ebooks and whatever. So tonight we're going to look at the ebook file formats. Now, to start this out, before we look at specific file formats, we need to find out what makes an ebook an ebook. And a little bit of gobbledygook here. There are common ebook features that are supported by most ebook file formats. And some of these features are supported by other types of file formats as well. However, there are some file formats that are very often used for ebooks that do not support common ebook features. So the other gotcha on this is the ebook file format in use might support all sorts of features, but unless the publisher or creator of the ebook implements them in the particular book, they won't be available. So in terms of features that are supported by most ebook file formats, probably the most important one is called Reflow. And this adapts the book's presentation to the in three ways. It adapts it to the output device, whether you're using a smartphone or an ebook reader, a computer or a tablet. It adapts the presentation accordingly. The other thing it adapts to is the device orientation on a smartphone. Some e-readers and some tablets in particular, you can turn the device to get either a portrait or a landscape view. And the other thing it adapts to is user-selected format changes. In a lot of cases, you can change the fonts, the font sizes, background colors, and other things. Now, Reflow is also supported by some file formats that are not specifically ebook formats, like Microsoft Word, rich text format, and most other word processor formats. The caveat there being is if the author of the document used hard carriage returns and hard page breaks, it defeats the Reflow function. Other features supported by most ebook file formats include embedding of pictures, illustrations, audios, and videos. There's enhanced type settings, and this allows the user to change fonts and font sizes without messing up the page layouts, even when you use very large font sizes. And this can be considered part of the Reflow function. Another great feature is page flip. It allows you to flip around through the book without losing your place. And another one is WordWise. If you click on a particular word or hover over it, depending on the reader you're using, you get a definition of what the word means. Another big feature is a table of contents, indexes, and references. And these are all built into the main document itself and contain internal and external hyperlinks. This is also supported by PDF and some word processor file formats, where if you're in the table of contents, you can click on something and you go taken right away to that part of the document. Same with the indexes and references. Now, some of the ebook file formats, as well as PDFs, support what they call sidebar or metadata table of contents, where the table of contents isn't embedded in the document itself. It's a separate thing where you click on an icon, and it opens up a sidebar table of contents. And then from there, you can click on it and go to that spot in the document. Now, there's probably at least 20 different file formats used for ebooks. And so we're just going to have a quick look at the five most popular. And the last two of these aren't really ebook file formats, but they're very popular for ebooks anyway. The big one is EPUB. EPUB is free to use. It's an open standard. It's vendor independent, and it's probably the most common ebook format out there, or at least non-proprietary ebook format. The ebook EPUB file is an unencrypted zipped archive which contains directories and files within it, and the e-reader device or the application uncompresses and puts these all together and presents the ebook to you. There's internal media overlays so you can have synchronized audio narration, and so the ebook can be both an ebook and an audiobook, though dedicated audiobooks have their own file formats. The EPUB supports color images, scalable vector graphics, interactive elements, and full videos. The interactive elements are things like page bookmarking, passage highlighting, and the ability to take notes on a particular book. This is particularly important if you're studying the book for a course or for school or something. EPUBs can support digital rights management or copy protection, but the EPUB specification doesn't specify a particular DRM methodology. That's up to the publisher. And that can include just simple copy protection, or can include stuff like when you download a library book, the book disappears in 3 weeks. Now, most of the Amazon Kindle devices, Amazon Kindle is a very popular e-reader family. They cannot read the EPUBs, but pretty much all the other major e-book readers can support them. Now, the AZW, AZW3, et cetera, these are Amazon's proprietary e-book formats for their Kindle readers and the Kindle apps for smartphones, tablets, and computers. You can download and install the Kindle apps on your smartphone, tablet, or computer. They're free. But if you want to buy the actual e-reader, it costs some serious dollars. These formats, similar to EPUB, support video and sound, page bookmarking, passage highlighting, notes, and other features. And pretty much all the Kindle books have digital rights management and copy protection. An interesting feature of these is if you're reading a Kindle book on something like your smartphone while you're out and about and you come home and you open up the book on your Kindle reader or on your computer, it opens up the same place you left off on your smartphone. This works well on about 75% of the books, and the other times it doesn't quite sync up the way it should. If you're using a Windows computer with the Kindle app, Kindle files are usually in a subdirectory with supporting files. The subdirectory and the file names are usually obfuscated or anonymized, so it's not clear what book they are for or what the files do. An example is the Kindle app installs the files in a directory called My Kindle Content, and then you get the obfuscated name of the book there for the subdirectory, and then the files within it are, again, obfuscated, so at least you can match up those files to the particular book, but that's about it. Now, KeyPub, this is Kobo's proprietary variant of EPUB. Kobo is the most popular e-reader family in Canada, and they've basically fashioned their file format on the EPUB with just some minor changes. The KeyPubs can only be read with a Kobo e-reader or the free Kobo apps for your smartphone, tablet, or computers. Most of the Kobo books also have DRM and are copy protected. On a Windows computer with the Kobo app, the file name has no extension and the name of the book is obfuscated. And like the EPUB, the file is a container for all the subdirectories and files required to display the book. An example of how it's structured is below there. It's hidden away in the app data directories, and the names of the book are obfuscated, so you don't know which book it's for. The PDF isn't specifically an ebook document format. However, it's very, very widespread and in use all over the place, and so they've become a very popular way of delivering the ebooks. The PDFs are designed as a part of what they do to mimic printed documents, and so they don't support some ebook features, and the biggest thing they don't support is the reflow. So it doesn't resize and whatever to the device you're reading it on. Now, apparently some of the e-readers can sort of separate the content of a PDF from the formatting and give it some sort of reflow, but that's a sort of kludgy way of doing it. Like the EPUB, the PDFs support interactive elements like annotations, form fields, pictures, and various audio and video content. The PDF was originally proprietary to Adobe, but it's now an open international standard under ISO 32000. So and it's no longer a proprietary format. The fourth big ebook format is a rich text format, and the key word here is text. This RTF is compatible with every major e-reader on the market, including the Kindle, the Kobo, and the Sony. It supports embedded pictures and illustrations, and it supports embedded objects like tables and charts from a spreadsheet application. However, in actual use, instead of linking to that, the tables and charts basically have to be copied and pasted in. Because the rich text file might not be able to link with the spreadsheet. This format is proprietary to Microsoft. However, they publish the specifications for it and allow other companies to use it royalty-free. But they control the specifications, and so any improvements or whatever is strictly up to Microsoft. Now, most of the e-readers also support plain text. The rich text format has an advantage over this because you can retain special characters, the text formatting, font sizes, and other such things. Both of these formats support the reflow. Now, that covers the five major file formats used for e-books. And it's quite common that people want to convert between one format and another. One of the best ways to do this is the Calibre eBook Manager. This is a free application. We talked about it a couple weeks ago. And one of the functions it does, besides being a great eBook reader and a great library manager, is it has a converter function. It can convert any one of several formats to any one of a number of other formats. And it also allows you to edit the text, edit the metadata, change the text size and fonts, and a bunch of other things. So it's a way of creating ebooks as well as converting them. Now, the reality is if you have files from a Kindle or a Kobo or other proprietary formats that have digital rights management, you first need to remove the digital rights management or the copy protection before you can convert it. In some countries, removing the DRM is illegal. In some other countries, you're allowed to remove the DRM in order for the owner to back up the files and otherwise use them for their own personal use. But it's still illegal to remove the DRM for the purpose of distributing copies of the book to others or to remove the time limitations on a library book. Now, I'm not a lawyer, and that's not a full legal opinion. So Michael Geist, that Chris talked about, can probably give you a more accurate description. But effectively speaking, you're the owner of that copy of the ebook, and you can do what you want with it for your own personal use only. Now, there's an application called EPUBOR, and this is a good app for converting DRM books because in one step it removes the DRM and does the conversion. In other cases, you can Google it. There's all sorts of apps out there that can remove the DRM, and then you got to use other apps like Calibre to do the conversion. So this is a one-stop shopping type of thing. Just a quick note on e-readers. In Canada, Kobo, which is supported by Indigo Chapters Coles, has 45% of the dedicated e-reader market. And they have the apps you can put on your smartphones and computers and tablets. Kindle, which is an Amazon product, has 25 to 30% of the market. Sony's in third place, and the balance is shared by a whole whack of other brands. And these are 2016 figures. They might have changed a bit since then. But at some point in the future, I'll do a brief overview of e-readers and e-reader apps so you can look at what features are important to you. And do you have to spend money on an e-reader, or can you get by with a free app to do it with? And that's it for today.
Thanks, Bob. We have a couple of questions on that went into the chat. Natalie had a question about what does the library use in OverDrive, and Tom chimed in with OverDrive uses mostly EPUB and some are PDFs, and they also have audiobooks as well, MP3, usually at 64kbps encoding. Natalie commented that it seemed to have limited options layout and dictionary, and I guess that leads back, Bob, to what you were talking about, whether the publisher actually implements any of the features or not. So I would guess that even within OverDrive, people might find more features on one book versus another, I'm guessing. Do you have a lot of experience at all, Bob, with the library in OverDrive?
No, I have absolutely no experience whatsoever.
Okay.
When we were discussing set up the presentation I just gave, Alan mentioned that the library might have made some recent changes, but I went on their website to see what that was about, and I have to say that their website can use some work, so I sort of put it on my to-do list to actually talk to you, Chris, get a contact at the library, and see if I can get some more information. and perhaps present it at a later point in time.
Yeah, okay. I seem to recall something very recently that they put out an email or something that they were actually getting rid of OverDrive. I'm not sure if I read this wrong.
No, it's not that, Chris.
Oh, okay.
They switched from OverDrive to an app called Libby, and now they're getting rid of Libby, and they want you to use a web browser. It's not clear to me, and Bob's absolutely right. The library website is the worst website in the world, I think. It's not clear to me, though, if you use a web browser, can you download the book and have it and read it offline?
Yeah.
It makes no sense to me if I have to use a web browser and I've got to have an internet connection to read my e-books.
Yeah, that's pretty sick.
But the other thing is, the OverDrive app, the original one, still seems to be available for the PC. So I'm wondering whether I can just go back to OverDrive and not worry about it. And that's why I was asking Bob, because I thought he would know all those good things.
Okay, well, I can definitely reach out to the library and get some contact information from them. They may even want to come onto one of our Q&As and do mini presentation themselves on their services. But I will touch base with them and see if we can at least find out some more information. Corinne had the question, if you're visually impaired, would ebooks be read by an application that reads the text? Does anybody know about that? So some kind of...
Tom says some devices do, and a PC screen reader should work.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about the answer that I would give as well.
Okay.
And some of the ebooks have the audio sort of built in. But if you're that visually impaired, you might want to consider using a or getting an audio book instead.
Yeah, it's Corinne. I'm just thinking about books that are more like textbooks and not like fiction or whatever. And so not all of them are in audio format. So that's why I asked the question. I think I guess I'd have to do more investigating myself on that.
Yeah.
You know, because there used to be a product called Dragon, you know, Dragon Naturally Speaking. So
it's still out there.
Yeah. So I was wondering if you could use the ebook as input to that product.
I'm not sure how to do that. Actually, I have a license for Dragon, and they keep on sending me renewal notices to upgrade to the latest version.
Okay.
But I haven't used it that extensively in the last few years, so I'm not sure.
But it is a screen reader, so it should be able to work if it can see the content on screen.
Is it screen reader, or is it you talk?
Oh, sorry, sorry.
Dictates?
Yeah, it's dictation, yeah.
You can per se.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're running along here on time, so thanks very much, Bob. And I think we should turn it back over to Alan to continue on.
Okay, all right. So our first question of the night is almost a follow-up from the discussion we had last week about a Windows computer dying and how do I get my data back. I'd suggested maybe running a live Linux distro. And Wes had he'd been reading this posting by Ask Leo, which was how to boot Linux once. So he wants to know, how do we boot Linux once? Can he create a bootable flash drive? And what Linux distro, I guess, would somebody recommend? So in terms of creating a live USB or a live DVD, that should be, a live DVD, CDs are generally too small for Linux distros these days. The common ones are things like Ubuntu, but personally I like Linux Mint and I like the Cinnamon edition because that one is much more like Windows than is Ubuntu. And the current version of Linux Mint is 20.1 Lissa. And if you go to their website, you can actually pick on the Cinnamon edition and then you can download the 64-bit Ubuntu, and Linux is a variant of Ubuntu. Neither are supporting 32-bit computers anymore. So if you need a 32-bit a distro, you need to go to a different version of Linux. But basically, you get a choice of three different desktops. As I said, I like Cinnamon. And then you choose a mirror, and the Canadian ones are here. University of Waterloo is a good one. Manitoba Unix Group I've used extensively. You download the file, and you get this ISO file for Linux Mint. So now you need to burn this ISO file to a USB or, as I say, a DVD. If you're going to use a USB, I mean, the beauty of this is anybody who hasn't tried Linux, you don't have to spend any resources. If you've got an old USB lying around that's got a couple of gig on it even, or anything even larger than that, you can use it to create a live USB. You can play with Linux to your heart's content. If you don't like it, you reformat the USB, and it hasn't cost you a cent. And basically, you've got the ISO, you've downloaded the ISO, you now need some software, and in Windows, I would use Rufus, and here you're seeing the screen for Rufus. So up here, you choose the device, the stick that you're going to use, and I'm using a 2 gigabit stick, which I previously had Puppy Linux on. You then select the distro that you want to download, the ISO file that you want to burn, and then leave everything else as the default values, because it will just work. And just press the start button right here, and it will burn your USB, and you're ready to go. If you've got a much bigger USB drive, like 8 gigabytes, say, or even bigger than that, it's kind of a waste to only have one distro burnt to that big USB drive. So what I do is I use Yumi, which is a multi-boot creator. So I can use this thing and burn several different versions of Linux and different Linux utilities like Gparted, for example, onto a single USB. And then they have a menu system built in. You just choose which distro you want to load into memory and run the program. So this is a very similar process. Here's where we choose the drive that we're going to burn to, the target drive. We select Linux Mint. It asks us to browse for the ISO file. We give it the 64-bit ISO file, and we tell it to create, and it will create the menu entry. So now what you need to do is boot your USB. So you plug the USB into a USB port on the computer, And you need to know the magic command that will let you choose that USB as the boot device. And my computers are Dell, and on Dell I hit F12, and it basically pops up this menu right here. And so I scroll up and down until I find my my USB drive, select that, and then press Enter, and it boots. And it boots straight into Linux. So here is Linux Mint, the Cinnamon Edition, running on my computer from a live USB. It hasn't touched anything on the hard drive. So I'm just running basically this thing from the USB and using the computer's memory. Couple of important things to look at. This guy down here, little folder, is the files menu. So it's like Windows Explorer. And this guy over here, which is a little double arrow kind of thing, is where you access the network. So if I click on network, then it pops up and it finds my router, dual band router, so I've got two different frequencies running. If I click on one of these guys, then it will ask for my Wi-Fi password and it will just instantly connect. And now I can browse the internet, get my email, all from this live USB on the Linux. If I go back and hit the files icon here, then it pops up the file manager. Now this is, I said it's like File Explorer, but this is a unit, this is a Linux file manager. I think this is Nautilus. And by default, it's showing me the home directory, which are, these are the Linux file folders. However, if you look down on the left-hand sidebar here, you can see it sees other devices. It sees a data disk, which is my data partition, drive D. It sees Windows 10, which is drive C. And it also sees an 8 GB SD card, which I use for real-time backup. So if I click on Windows 10, then you probably recognize this as being the Windows drive, Windows C drive. There's the recycle bin. There's the users. Here's the Windows directory and all the other junk I've got on my C drive. So if my computer had crashed and I couldn't boot it into Windows, clearly when I boot into a live Linux USB, I can see my Windows drive, and it's not my Windows drive that's the problem, because I can see all my files and I can grab the important files that I need to back up before I try and fix my unbootable computer. Another neat thing about this thing is that the next time you go into the desktop, because it's mounted the Windows partition now, it shows up as an icon. So rather than having to go look for it in the file manager, I can just double click on this guy, and it will open up the files. And then if you really like Linux now, after all that trial and testing, and it's worked really, really well now, and then we've got another icon down here, we can click on this guy, and we actually get some choices to install Linux Mint on the hard drive. And I typically install it side by side with Windows, so I end up with a dual boot system and a menu at boot time. So I default to Linux Mint, but I can scroll down the menu and choose to boot into Windows instead. So I get the best of both worlds. One really best and one the other guy. Okay, that's it for how to boot into Linux. And if you really want to play with Linux, a live USB is a really good way to do it. No cost and very little effort. Okay, our next question, Chris is going to go through.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to actually, because I've got a bunch of builds on here, and just so I don't have to be saying next all the time, I'm going to take over the screen. And if I can just, okay, share screen and share. Okay, so this came in as a question and I've generalized it and anonymized it. But basically the idea was that one person, Sam, who received an email from a guy, we'll call him Dave. And Sam had not dealt with Dave for 10 years, and the email asked him to click on a Dropbox link within the email. He didn't click it. Kudos to him to being cautious about that. So Sam contacted Dave, and Dave said he didn't send it. And Dave said he had received a similar email himself. So Sam's contact info was in Dave's contact list, and Dave's contact list info was in Sam's contact list. So the question was, whose contact list had been compromised? Was it Sam's? Was it Dave's? Both? Is there any way that you can actually tell? So if we look at this situation, what would happen if Dave, the first person that, you know, supposedly sent this email, what would happen if that contact list was compromised? So the attacker gets a hold of Dave's contact list, and he sent an attacking email to Sam with that fraudulent link in it that going off to somewhere else. He spoofed the from to Dave's address so that Sam, when he got it, he thought that it was coming from Dave. And it included that link to the compromised doc. And it might look something like this. So from Dave to Sam, and really look at this important information with a link in it. So that's the sort of beginning of what we had from the previous slide. But the attacker wants to have more victims. So, of course, he's got access to Dave's contact list. So he's going to send the same email to all of these people in the contact list from Dave, hoping that they'll click on it and compromise their computers. But in addition to that, he actually has one more email address that he can attack. He can actually attack Dave's. So he can do all of the people in Dave's contact list, but he can also attack Dave. So he'll send an email saying randomly, he'll pick one of the email addresses in the contact list, and he'll say, oh, it's from this person, and send it to Dave, and hopefully Dave will end up clicking on that link. So what would Sam see? So all Sam would see is, as we described on the first slide, is the email from Dave to Sam with that link. And if you think about it, without any sort of verification that this was a legitimate email, the known sender, okay, so that looks legitimate. The language maybe looks normal, so that might pass scrutiny. The URL may look legitimate, so it may pass scrutiny on that. And if you click the link, because it was a fraudulent email, you're probably going to end up with a compromised computer or your credentials stolen. Something bad is likely to happen when you click that link. So what would Dave see? Well, you know, this supposedly came from Dave, but it was actually spoofed. You know, it didn't actually come from Dave. So Dave would see nothing. So none of the emails went through his mailbox. So in the immediate sense, he's not going to even notice anything. Or if the attacker also sent him an attack email, then he would see that one email that came from one of the contacts, whatever one the attacker chose at random. And so he would get that one email, and he'd be just like the other victims. Without verifying it, you know, known sender might look okay. The language might look okay. The URL might look okay. If you click the link, you end up with a compromised computer, just like all the other victims. So what would Dave see later? Well, because all these other people got an email that said it was from Dave, he might end up with things like Sam sending him a reply and saying, did you really mean to send this to me? Or Pete at nowhere.org might say, what? My antivirus is going nuts. So he went to the link, and fortunately his antivirus happened to pick up on it and blocked him or whatever. Sally at ISP.net might say, thanks, Dave, cool. So Sally probably actually clicked on the link, hasn't noticed that her computer has been compromised, but probably is. Ted at Turner.news might say, thanks, I passed it on to CNN. Watch the news tonight. So it looks like probably Ted, you know, actually clicked the link as well. Ned at Simpsons.tv might say, Oakley Dokley, neighborino. So he probably also clicked the link. So he's going to end up getting this flurry of replies to messages that he didn't send, things he doesn't know anything about. But because if he's at all savvy, he'll realize that somebody has spoofed his email. So the best thing that he could do is send an email to all his contacts saying that, hey, if you got this email come through with, you know, subject line, important information, you know, it wasn't me. You know, somebody spoofed my address. Advise the people what to do. Delete the email. Don't click on any of the links. If you did click the link, you know, you may have a compromised computer and get it checked out. So just a couple of other email cautions. Don't trust the sender email address. Email is totally unauthenticated. So there have been some attempts at authentication. They're far from universal. And because of that, most people will accept mail even if it is unauthenticated. So it's safest to just assume that all email is unauthenticated. The sender address can be anything at all, have no bearing on reality. So email address is easily spoofed. And if you get email addresses that are stolen from a friend's contact list, it could be a familiar address. Look for red flags, unusual tone or language or spelling, grammar, especially if it's from a company. Usually they're pretty good at a company and making sure that the emails that they actually sent out are grammatically correct, their spelling is correct, that they look professional. Anything that urges quick action. The attackers want you to do things without thinking. They're going to threaten bad things if you don't act. You know, your email is going to be shut down, or you're going to have a charge on your credit card, or you're going to be arrested, or something like that. Anything that's too good to be true, the old adage probably isn't true if it's too good to be true. So if a Nigerian prince wants to give you $10 million, it probably isn't true. If you have an email giving a password to an attachment in the email, what attackers will sometimes do is they want to get their attacking document or attachment through to you. They don't want your antivirus program to pick up on it. So what they'll do is they'll maybe zip a file. They'll encrypt it so that the antivirus program can't examine it. And then in the email, they'll say, oh, the password to the attachment is such and such. If you think about it in a normal sense, that doesn't make sense. You know, to password protect a document and then send it out and give you the password in the same document or the same email, it just doesn't make sense. Asking you to enable macros, things like Microsoft Word documents can have macros embedded in them. They're very powerful. And they are disabled by default. And when you open one of them, it'll say, if you trust the source of this, you know, click here to enable macros. So they'll try to encourage you to actually enable those macros. Anything that asks for personal information, login information, passwords, anything personal, you know, look for that as a red flag. Asking for things a person normally wouldn't ask you for. This is often important in a business environment. If you have somebody who says that, you know, they work in personnel and you're in accounting and they're asking you for financial information, well, does that really make sense that that person would actually ask you for that information? So those are just some of the red flags to look for in emails to make sure that you don't get a compromised computer. Don't trust links in emails. Links can be obfuscated so that what you see is not what you get when you click on it. In the very least, hover the mouse over top of the link. You'll get a pop-up or the status bar will show you where it's actually going to take you. If the text in the email says Scotiabank and the pop-up says WordPress, don't click it. You know, there's somebody trying to trick you into thinking that you're going to go to Scotiabank when you're actually going to go to WordPress. Links can be obscure. So do you trust that following link that you see on the screen right there? That's actually a legitimate document that, you know, somebody had in Google Drive and they sent to me. And so, you know, do you trust it? I mean, it can look obscure. It might be legitimate. It might not. Don't trust attachments. If you get an attachment, if it's if you're uncertain about it, verify with the sender. Don't reply to the email. It could go back to the attacker who will say, oh, yeah, it's a perfectly good attachment. So use a trusted email address, a phone or text or something like that to verify with the sender. In particular, if you can't verify with the sender, check at virustotal.com. Take the attachment and upload it to virustotal.com. If it reports out of its 60-odd antivirus engines that the attachment is actually fine, then to be totally safe, wait 2 days, check again before you actually open that attachment. That will give time for brand new malware to start to spread, and various antivirus companies will have gotten a copy of it by 2 days. At that point, they will be flagging it as being bad. It's not 100% guaranteed, but that's a pretty good indication that the file is okay. If VirusTotal after 2 days still thinks it's fine. Some other protections, just keep your antivirus up to date, keep your software patched for security vulnerabilities, keep your firewall on, and practice good password habits. And at the April OPCUG meeting, I will be talking about how to deal with passwords. And that's it for me on that. So I will stop share.
Chris, Tom's making a comment, probably in the same email group, e.g. Yahoo groups or Google groups, current or historical. Not sure what that's. We're talking about the two guys being compromised?
But it wouldn't necessarily be the case. I don't see why it would necessarily be more likely or not. I'm not sure. Tom, if you wanted to clarify on that, exactly what you mean, we could discuss it. So,
hello?
Yep.
Yes, if you join a group then you basically can accumulate all of the addresses of people who post to it, and presumably they all have some connection between each other, and so you can identify them. They may look as friends to each other.
Yep. Good point. Yep.
And Rob's asking, how would the attacker make the connection between the two emails initially? Would one of the computers have been compromised initially?
Yeah, almost certainly in the scenario that I put forward, it was that one person, in this case it was Dave, he was compromised, and the attacker got a hold of his contact list. But strictly speaking, I mean, just because email isn't authenticated, however somebody can get an email address, they can start trying to attack other people. The benefit of doing it through one person's contact list is when he attacks, sends these attacking emails saying the emails are coming from the person whose computer was compromised, then he's pretty much guaranteed that all of those people in the contact list know that originator and are more likely to trust the email. So that's really where that comes from.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Some good tips in there.
Okay.
Okay, our next question is dealing with a broken webcam on an old laptop. First question, can Windows 10 block the software for the webcam? And secondly, considering using an Android tablet or a Samsung phone as a camera, and what are the issues before downloading the relevant apps? So first of all, if we think about Windows blocking the webcam, it certainly could do, because if you go to permissions, if you go to settings and privacy and camera, you'll find that the camera can be either enabled or disabled. You may find that it needs an administrator's account to deal with that. And you can also enable it only for certain applications. And so if we go to the settings, you can see here that access for the device is turned on. And if I wanted to change that, I'd have to use my administrator's account, because I'm looking at this as a regular Windows user. But I could also turn on or off allowing various applications to access the camera. And that's the global one, either all apps or no apps. But if you scroll down here, then you'll find that there's a whole bunch of Microsoft Store apps that can be turned on or off as you wish. And if you scroll further down, then you'll find some desktop apps, some things which are installed already to access the camera. So things like GoToMeeting, and here's the Zoom client, which last time I used it was February the 17th. I wonder what I was doing then. The webcam's broken, so it's a kind of a an alternate to if it isn't broken, don't fix it. If it is broke, do fix it. Why not fix it with a new webcam? But since it's an old laptop, and since it's a laptop, fixing the webcam may not be for the faint of heart. So the easiest way to fix it, as it is with a number of things on laptops, is to use an external device. So a USB webcam might be the thing. Just hang this on the laptop screen and plug in the cable to the nearest USB port. And here's a couple of $40 Microsoft and Logitech web cameras from, I think that's Canada Computers, for example. But you can buy these things from Amazon and so forth. However, the thought was to use the smartphone as a webcam. And the way that you would do that, there's an article here from PC Magazine on how to use a phone as a wireless webcam. Basically, you need some software. So I'm looking at an Android smartphone, for example, or tablet. So you need to use DroidCam as the Android app and also their Windows client. And then if you had that software, then you could use your smartphone as a camera on the PC using it with things like Zoom or Skype, for example. And so download the apps and then use the phone as the camera for the computer. And to me, that seems like an awful lot of trouble. So my question is, or my suggestion is, why not just use the Zoom app on the phone directly? You can download this Zoom Cloud Meetings app and then just run the smartphone as your connection to Zoom. So here's an example from from their website of a whole bunch of people plugged into the Zoom client. So to me, that's the easiest way to use a smartphone or a tablet as a webcam. I don't know if anybody else has any other thoughts on how you might fix a broken webcam on a laptop. I can't think of any way to do it other than by tearing the laptop apart, and that sounds hard.
Hi, it's Corrine. I asked a question. Sorry, I just wanted to clarify. Because I have this this old laptop, and I do have a smartphone and a tablet, because they have the camera features, I was just wanting to know if anybody has could put forward any issues as to why I wouldn't download these apps and use the apps. Your suggestion about using my smartphone for Zoom, the screen is too small anyways, especially when you're looking at presentations and stuff. So, you know, that wasn't an option that I would consider. So anyway, I just wanted to know if anybody had any experience or if they have any suggestions to be aware of.
Yeah, well, the obvious thing to do is to try this. I mean, it's an Android app, so it's going to be free to try, I should think. Mm-hmm. But I personally have no experience with it. And anybody else on the call knows anything about these things? Tom is suggesting using Chromecast from the phone to the TV.
Yeah, that'd be an option too. That you have there. Yeah, something like that could be sharing your screen right up onto the TV. But I think that long and short is that the simplest thing I would think is probably just getting a replacement webcam that plugs into a USB port. Be pretty simple.
And then you could use it with any computer.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Anyway, try droid.com, Natalie, and let us know how it works. Okay, we're at that time of the evening where we've run up to against the time constraint. But does anybody else have any other questions? I didn't see anything in the chat earlier that we've missed.
I don't think so.
Well, while you're thinking about it, I'll just go through the promos before we wrap up. And a couple of things coming up in the near future. On Monday, the Tech Cafe, the Ottawa Public Library's Tech Cafe. If you're interested in free software and you want to know more about free software that I use, then Monday at 4 p.m. Is free software really free? And the answer is yes. Is it any good? Yes. Give me my whole presentation.
You could have had a really short presentation. If it, no, it's not free and it's lousy. Thank you.
Oh, yes, it's free and it's great. You're fine. Have a nice day. All right. In the next week, March the 8th, Linda is going to be doing a session for the Tech Cafe on making hard copy books from digital photos. So if you're interested in publishing your very own coffee table volume using your favorite digital photos, Linda will show you how to. And then Chris has already mentioned that on the 10th, our next regular monthly meeting for the club is going to feature Chris talking about keeping passwords safe. And finally, next week is our next question and answer session. So if you have questions, consider the questions that we posed early, or topics that you want to share, send them along to suggestion box. And otherwise, we'll see you all next week on March the 3rd. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks very much, folks. Have a good week.